The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Taxi show.
Are you afraid of ventriloquist dummies? Do they just creep you out because they seem alive?
Well, don't touch that dial.
Because you know that one dummy that scares you the most? The one with the dead-looking eyes? Yeah, him. Anyway, if you turn this program off, he'll pop out of a cabinet when you least expect it.
He's in there now, listening, right now.
Shh, he can hear us.
And now your host,
take it away, big dummy,
Eric Metaxas.
Oh, my gosh. Hey, folks, it's Eric Metaxas. Today is Friday, what is today, the 19th?
The 19th of January.
Yes. Today's a big day, folks. I want to announce, in case you don't follow this stuff, today something's happening in Washington, D.C., which doesn't get the media coverage it deserves. It's called the March for Life. It's pro-life people marching in the hundreds of thousands. Busloads of young Catholics comprise a large portion of the crowd. In the frigid cold, every year, faithfully marching on their speakers. And it's done to mark the sad anniversary of the passing of Roe v. Wade, which made abortion legal in every state, despite, here's the key, despite what the people in that state feel. In other words, if you in your state vote and 90% of the people say we don't want abortion to be legal in our state, the Supreme Court said, tough luck. We don't care what you think. We found a place in the Constitution that provides a right for every woman to have an abortion anywhere in America. Now, that is a fiction. That's lunacy to say that the Constitution says that. But the justices in 1973 said that it said that, and we're a country of laws, and they get to decide what it says. So it is a sad day. It's a sad day in many ways, and it's opened the door to many people, many women who don't really want to get an abortion, thinking, oh, this is what I need to do. My boyfriend wants me to do this. My parents want me to do this. I don't want to do this, but, well, it's legal, so it can't be wrong. Well, it is wrong, and we have to have a lot of grace and love for those who've made this decision. I often talk about the fact that I was involved in making that decision way back in 1985. It was a bad decision. I made that decision. It horrifies me. But we need to have grace for people who made the wrong decision. But we also need to speak out really boldly and say it is the wrong decision. It's the wrong decision, not just for the baby, who deserves life just as much as any of us does, but it's wrong for the mother. Mothers get hurt by this. We're not allowed to talk about that. Anyway, today's the March for Life in Washington, D.C. And Albin, do you know that it's cold in Washington, D.C. in January? Did you know that?
I figured it out. Yeah.
It's kind of funny because everybody's bundled up. I spoke there last year and it was cold. It wasn't as cold as it often is. It's probably even colder this year.
But yeah, I think it's colder this year.
These people are out there. And one thing I wanted to say about the March for Life, which I think is a very important thing to say, Donald Trump, you might hate him, but you have to acknowledge that he's the first president in history ever to address the March for Life live via, like videotape or – no, not videotape.
Well, he's on – right. He's at the White House.
He's on the screen.
Right.
But he's addressing them live. Other presidents, a couple presidents have done it by phone. I think George W. Bush once did it by phone. But Trump is the first president ever to do this. And I also have to say that Mike Pence is the first vice president ever – to speak at the March for Life.
That was last year, and you were there last year as well.
And I was there, and I spoke last year. And so the reason I say this is because there's so much division around this presidency, but I want to say, folks, give somebody credit where credit is due. I don't care why Trump is doing this, frankly. The fact is that he's doing it.
Well, he's going to get a lot of heat, as you know, from the media, et cetera.
Well, I don't know if they're even going to – frankly, I don't know if they're going to report it. Because
well, if they do, it's
going
to be negative.
They're so bitter, and if there's anything that – they tend not to cover this kind of stuff. They don't give it any oxygen, which is one of the reasons I want to talk about it, because I want to give it oxygen. But I just think the March for Life is an important moment for us to acknowledge that we as a nation have made this – really sad decision in 1973. And most people that I talk to who are lawyers say this is very bad law. In other words, even if you are for abortion being legal, Roe v. Wade is horrible law. So when people talk about overturning Roe v. Wade, it's not about overturning women's right to an abortion, because frankly, the states decide that. The states always decided that. You can get an abortion in New York in 1972, no problem. But it's interesting. So that's another thing. But I just wanted to say that I was there last year, and it's an important moment. And I also want to say, and this is huge, whenever somebody criticizes Trump, no matter what you think of Trump, I just want to say it again. You don't have to like him, but Hillary Clinton would have been a very, very aggressively pro-abortion president. She's also I've called her the number one enemy of religious liberty in America. She spoke a lot of weasel words, giving lip service. She was absolutely committed to ending true religious liberty in America. She doesn't believe in it. I'm not going to get into that. But I'm saying that, you know, in all the Trump hating that goes on, at least have some perspective. And to people who say, like, I'll never vote for the lesser of two evils, that's still voting for an evil, that is sheer nonsense. And lunacy, there's nothing you can say to those people. If you're one of those people, I just think you're wrong. Okay,
yeah.
Let's turn to more positive stuff.
Yes.
Hey, CSI,
yes.
Albin.
Yes.
CSI, we're doing a campaign with CSI. It's a new campaign. It's a January campaign. A lot tougher to raise money in January. But here's the good news. We don't care. We believe in the work that Christian Solidarity International is doing around the world, mostly in Sudan. At this point in Sudan, they're rescuing Christians from slavery. The Muslims in Sudan enslaved many, many, many Christians during the war that was going on. When the war ended, governments did not force the slaves to be freed. They allowed the Sudan Muslims to keep the Christian slaves. And we've talked on this program, and we'll continue to talk on this program, about what that kind of slavery is like. It's horrific, horrific.
Yeah.
So if you want to do something about it, and I beg you to think about doing something about it, go to our website, metaxastalk.com, and you can click on the banner for CSI. Now, actually, before we say anything else, I always do this. I forget to say who we're talking to in this hour. In a few minutes, we're going to continue our conversation with Michelle Kami, K-A-M-H-I, Michelle Kami. She's a New Yorker, and she has done a lot of thinking and writing about what is art. She is fantastic.
Yes.
We had an hour-long conversation with her. We said we've got to continue the conversation. So in a couple of minutes, we continue the conversation with the great Michelle Kami. I love her. I want to do a Socrates in the City with her. She would be fantastic.
Mm.
Yes. Albin.
What?
Socrates in the City.
Yes.
We finally figured it out. February 26th, we're going to be doing a Socrates in the City event in New York City. Folks, mark your calendars. February 26th, New York City, Socrates in the City with Gabrielle Kubi. She is an amazing woman from Germany. She's flying in from Germany, and I'm going to have a conversation with her. I'll talk more about her in the weeks ahead, but
yes.
She is extraordinary. February 26th, mark your calendars if you want to come to New York. Also, March 20th, we're doing a Socrates in the City with Greg Thornberry.
Wow.
About his new book on Larry Norman. That's March 20th. Did I say that? March 20th. Anything else? Am I forgetting anything?
No. Don't forget, though, CSI. I do want to push that myself, because you and I have both contributed, of course, and it's just such a worthy cause. There's a banner. For $156, you provide life-saving aid. You give out water and food, blankets, coats, heaters, medicines. to people. Some of them, they're bringing them out. The money is used to buy people out of slavery. So CSI, the banner at the top of the page. And, of course, the phone number, 800-222-5909.
800-222-5909, 800-222-5909. Please give, folks. We are so grateful to you. God bless you. We'll be right back with Michelle Kami. Stick around.
It's Eric Metaxas Show. We're talking about art, art, art. You understand me? Art. With the author of a book called Who Says That's Art, Michelle Mortar Kami. Michelle, again, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Eric.
Terrific
to
have you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's fun to talk about everything. And when we're talking about this, we're sort of talking about everything. It's the theory of the universe.
Yes.
I want to go back because you have an objective view of what is art, which you get ultimately, I guess, from the ancient Greeks, from Aristotle. Mm-hmm. Where do we trace our idea of art, or the idea about art? Because we've had art from, you know, time immemorial. But art, the concept of art, discussing art, that I would say goes back to Aristotle.
Yes. Well, most directly, yes. And the important thing to remember is that how we form concepts, they don't form in a vacuum. We
right.
form concepts from recognizing similarities and differences between things that we observe in reality. And the ancients recognized that people did two basic kinds of activities. One was they called the arts the things that disciplines that people do to fulfill our needs.
Mm-hmm.
And the one category were the utilitarian practical arts that met our physical needs. And then there was another category of things like music and poetry that really didn't serve any physical needs, that served a psychological need.
Okay, so this is the difference between the decorative
exactly,
arts.
Exactly. And it's fundamental to the whole difference, that distinction between the practical arts and the arts that unfortunately came to be regarded by some people as useless. But they weren't useless. They were profoundly important psychologically. That was their function.
It's interesting because there's a book called The Geography of Nowhere by a friend, James Howard Kunstler. And in that book, he talks about what's happened with regard to city planning or the lack of city planning and buildings. And he talks about he quotes it's the famous quote. I guess what I'm trying to say is that you would, even if you don't believe in God or anything, you sort of end up using words like soul, because you say that certain things feed the soul. And mm-hmm. what's his name who just passed away, the Yale art historian who said that the one strode into the old Penn Station like a god. And he says, now one scuttles in like a rat. And you think, what is that? In other words, what is it that something sort of seems to lift the soul to to ennoble us?
Right.
You walk into a glorious building with columns and something happens within us that you can't say is nothing. And then you go into the new the Penn Station. And it's grotesque. It's cramped. It seems
horrible experience.
It seems to crush the spirit.
Right.
But it's not something that is easily discussed. In other words, what is it that even the term to ennoble someone mm-hmm. or to crush someone's spirit, those are abstract. Those are difficult to – but you know, you're saying that even the ancients understood this idea, that we are more than atoms.
Yes. And one thing I should mention that's important for your listeners to know is that the book doesn't just criticize the things that I reject, but it also tries to – give an understanding of what genuine art gives us, what the experience of real art does for us, how it enriches our experience. One of the most wonderful comments I received was from a young serviceman who said he had the book and he hadn't known anything about visual art, but he, reading the book, gave him a sense of what riches he was missing and mm-hmm. how much he could gain in his own personal life from the experience of genuine art. You're right, it's difficult to pinpoint the qualities. You mentioned Roger Kimball before, and Kimball's rejection of the first book that I did with my husband, What Art Is, he said the important thing isn't to say what art isn't, but just the difference between good art and bad art. But you can't really say what makes something good art unless you have a sense of what art is. You can't say that a chair isn't a good chair if you don't know that chairs are meant to be sat on and that they need at least three legs to perform that function. And it's the same thing with art. So what I've tried to do is explain what the essential characteristics of visual art, because it gets much more complicated when you're speaking about all of the art forms. But the visual art is, let's see if we can find what I said. Visual art is imagery that skillfully represents real or imagined people, places, and things in a form expressive of the maker's temperament, deeply held values, and view of life. And there are many different, and that's not necessarily the best definition possible, but all genuine art, I say, has certain essential attributes. I say that it's imagery, that it's made with special skill. Nowadays, it's very common to speak about accidental art or found art. It consists of two or three dimensional representations of people, places, objects, or events. They're not abstract because we don't understand the world in abstract terms. We don't experience the world in terms of blotches of color. We experience it as percepts, a human being, an animal, a tree, a landscape. And such imagery, while not necessarily realistic in style, is intelligible within its cultural context. It embodies in comprehensible forms ideas and values that are important to the individuals who create them and have the potential to interest and move others. Finally, a true work of art is the product of more than just technical skill. It involves a personal sensitivity, talent, or vision, which enables the painter or sculptor to bring a subject to life and imbue it with meaning in a compelling way. The most extraordinary instances of this elusive quality are referred to as artistic genius, another concept that has been thrown out the window. And what's interesting is that if you examine other cultures, in ancient China, there was a great deal written about art, and the same ideas occur, that art is more than just representing reality in a very in a very photographic or precise way. It has to be imbued with a certain spirit.
Right. This is very heavy stuff because we're talking about – I mean, when you look at what's been pushed forward as modern art, whether it's Andy Warhol or Jackson Pollock, right, it strikes me that they are not only devoid of meaning, but they're trying to put forward something that is anti-meaning,
right.
That they're the enemies of meaning.
Yes.
And that they're the champions of meaninglessness and randomness.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And even said as much explicitly statements that I quote in the book that show they admit it.
And well, let me ask you, in some place in Moby Dick, Captain Ahab, who is kind of a demonic figure, filled with anger, he talks about wanting to punch or to break through the mask, as if he wants to strike at God directly. And it strikes me that some of what's happening with the art or so-called art that we're talking about, it has that element that they're wanting to put forward an idea that is it's not just anti-meaning, it's anti all these things that they regard as bourgeois values, love, family, whatever it is. We're gonna be right back talking about art with Michel Marder-Kami. The website is aristos.org, aristos.org. The book is Who Says That's Art. We'll be right back.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me.
This is Eric Metaxas' show. We're talking about art. Art. Do you understand art? The author of a new book, Who Says That's Art, is with me in the studio, Michel Marder-Kami. Welcome back. Where in the world do we go? There's so much to talk about. This is deep stuff, Michel. You've waded into some deep waters here.
Indeed.
Right?
Yes. And I'm so glad that you saw that it needed more than half an hour.
I think we can continue this conversation indefinitely because it's
absolutely.
Just so
– And it's an inexhaustible.
It's wide-ranging. Mm-hmm. I think it's extremely important. I don't just think it's interesting. I think it's very important for us to understand the basics of what does it mean to be human. Why should we even have a category such as art, and why should these things mean anything? But I was saying before we went to the break that in Moby Dick, Ahab at some point talks about wanting to, I can't remember if he says to punch through the mask or to strike through the mask, that he's sort of angry at all of creation because creation is made by this God whom he hates. He just is filled with anger at the injustice of his life and losing his leg and so on and so forth. And I feel that there is something of that spirit in some of these more contemporary
nihilism
artists. Yes, a kind of nihilism. I mean, Damien Hirst, my gosh, when you're putting a shark in plexiglass or whatever it was. I mean, it seems to be some of this stuff is nihilistic. And then the other aspect of this is that it seems to me to be very aggressively dismissive of people and what I earlier described as, you know, bourgeois sensibilities. The idea of beauty is somehow repulsive to these people. They think of beauty as – they think of a Hummel figurine. That's their idea of beauty. It's this kitschy, stupid thing. I mean, beauty itself, I want to ask you about that. I know that someone wrote a book about beauty, some Harvard art critic, art philosophy – a philosopher wrote a book on beauty maybe 10 years ago. But the concept of beauty has been on the outs in the world of art for decades.
Right. It's interesting that you mention that. I don't really discuss beauty as such that much in the book. What I do is I discuss values. And the reason for that is that the fine arts have often been defined in terms of beauty, And in a sense, that's too narrow and too broad, because if you define it just in terms of beauty, you don't have a distinction between the visual, between the major art forms and the decorative arts. Decorative art can be very beautiful. What's important in the fine arts, in art with a capital A, as it's sometimes called, is the beauty of what? The beauty of a woman, the beauty of a child, the beauty of a landscape. So it's not just the beauty, it's the larger idea and value that's
Well,
that's
I mean,
involved.
That's why when you if you think of the sculpture, some of right here at the Metropolitan Museum, Rodin's what are those sculptures? Hunger. I mean, they're almost grotesque. They're painful to look at, but there's a beauty there.
Yes, a power.
There's power.
It's meaningful.
Meaningful.
And that's so much of great art is not just beautiful. There's the sublime. There are things that are ugly, but they're meaningful.
Right.
If you understand them in the context.
But don't you think that a lot of purveyors of art in more recent decades have almost they've fetishized the idea of wanting to portray ugliness so that it's not just they're portraying something that's physically unpleasant, but they're pointing to a larger idea, a narrative, as it were, that the whole world is meaningless. I mean, look, I just watched maybe Woody Allen's worst film that he's ever made is the most recent one called Wonder Wheel. I just saw it. We always see his films. And normally, even when they're not great, they're decent. But the film was – there was not a joke, I don't think, in the film. And he was clearly trying to portray a Eugene O'Neill kind of – you know, reality, life is disturbing and dark, you know, and that's the whole idea,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
And so the film ended really unpleasantly. I mean, the antithesis of any kind of redemption and just bleak and sad. And but that's a worldview.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that I think it's kind of taken over in the last decades, if not in the
and
last.
And it tends to be it. I think that the reason why it's become so dominant is because it seems to the critics who cover art, many of them, it seems to correspond to their worldview, their view of life, and they make the mistake of thinking that that should be shared by everyone.
Well, but I mean, I would say that they feel that it's their duty to make people uncomfortable, that you know that the bourgeois suburban woman, let's say, who comes to these museums when she has a moment, that it's their job to tell her that her life is a joke and she's meaningless and she's a cliche and she should move to Greenwich Village or something stupid.
Right,
I don't know, but
it
seems like that's part of what's animating a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely an elitism involved. We know better than you. And, you know, we're the experts. And as I say, this is the main reason why I wrote the book, to let people know that
they're not crazy.
Right. Their intuitive responses have a legitimacy.
We'll be right back. Who Says That's Art is the book. It's the Eric Metaxas Show.
A starry summer night or a snow-covered winter's day.
What about a dumpster? Hey, Ray Stevens, what about a dumpster? What about a rat eating its child? I mean, my goodness. Okay, we're talking about art, we're talking about beauty, and I disagree with Ray Stevens. I just want to say, just had to say that up front. We are talking with Michelle Martyr Kami. We only have a few minutes left, Michelle, today. I'd love to have you back just to kind of ramble on, because this is so deep and wonderful and interesting. But you said before we went to the break that part of why you wrote Who Says That's Art is to let people know that their common sense view, their instincts are not wrong about what is beautiful, what is true, what is art.
Trust yourself.
Trust yourself. Come closer to the mic. Tell me more about that, because we've been told precisely the opposite.
Yes. Well, as I say in the section on the pleasures of art and how to enjoy art, the best way is to go with a friend whom you like, or a friend or a relative, and just look at the work and respond to it on your own terms and talk about what it is that you're responding to and what feelings it generates in you, and then what aspects of the work contribute to those feelings. And that's the best way to appreciate art. And as I say, since art is about life, you already have the equipment to understand it because you know about life. You've lived it.
Well, I mean, but it depends on what you're looking at, right? In other words, if you go to MoMA or, God forbid, the Guggenheim, you know, you're going to see things that are not...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm speaking about the experience of real art, of genuine art.
The Metropolitan Museum of Art, you could wander in there and you could be staring at a Bruegel, and that's just glorious stuff to look at.
Sad to say, however, the Metropolitan Museum has now its own horrors.
Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. They have many exhibitions of contemporary work.
That's more recent. I mean, I guess my point is that the fixed collections, the permanent collections are safe.
Right. The earlier work, pre-20th century and some of the 20th century work.
If somebody comes to New York, where would you say that they should wander first?
I would say that one of the most wonderful experiences, because it's on a small scale, is the Frick Collection, which Frick was extraordinary. I have a section in the book about contrasting today's collectors with the great collectors of the past. And Henry Clay Frick would not buy a work until he had it on loan and lived with it for a few months to be sure that it really spoke to him.
Wow.
And so his collection is extraordinary. It's a really genuine masterpieces in a beautiful, elegant setting.
Oh, the setting. My gosh. The setting is on Fifth Avenue and
70th Street. I think, yeah.
And it is a glorious mansion with a courtyard, and it is festooned, filled with beautiful, beautiful art.
Yes.
If you come to New York, I would say that what a great place to start. Frick.
Yes, because the Met can be overwhelming.
Yeah.
It
is overwhelming. Yes. It's fatiguing.
Yes, yes. And the best to do, I think, is to walk through, maybe pick one period and just go through and see what catches your eye.
Mm.
Things will jump out at you. And if it does, then you stop and look at it more closely.
Do you appreciate the Impressionists? Because I often think that Impressionism led to abstract art, that at some point a line was crossed. What do you think of Impressionism?
I think that it's interesting that, unlike abstract art, although Impressionism was reviled at first, within a relatively short time it had gained acceptance among critics as well as the public. Mm. Abstract art has been around for a century, and it still hasn't gained.
It's still, you know why? Because it's still ugly.
There's nothing.
It's still ugly.
It's unintelligible.
I have some friends that would disagree strongly with me, maybe with both of us on this, but I think that you can find abstract art that is not something that I find repulsive, but it's rare. I think
the more important thing is that it's not really intelligible. You can say, oh, it's pleasant, but what does it mean?
And then you know what the rejoinder is. Oh, it means whatever you want,
it to mean.
It's a Rorschach blot made by somebody with an MFA. It's kind of interesting. So would you say that those things are then fall into the category of being merely decorative?
Some of abstract?
Yeah.
Yeah, a Jackson Pollock is an interesting pattern.
Yeah.
You know?
I guess what I'm trying to say is that there are things that I've seen. There are abstract images that I've seen that are pleasant. I wouldn't mind having it on the wall. Mm-hmm. It's pleasant. But it's kind of like saying –
It's like wallpaper.
It's like wallpaper. I like that wallpaper, but is it art? Yeah. Well, I don't know. I do know that anything that's arch, like Andy Warhol, I find off-putting, and I think most people do. They don't know what
Let
to
me
think.
Tell your listeners that a wonderful 20th century painter who has whose centenary has just been celebrated, not by any of the major museums, is Andrew Wyeth. And we have a special issue on him in Aristos coming out shortly, an appreciation of his work and indicating how sadly he has been neglected.
Right.
Because of the dominance of abstract,
I love art. I love Andrew Wyeth, and I also love N.C. Wyeth.
Yes,
I love love that stuff. W Y E T H. Well, Wyeth.
You will like this issue.
And it's and I can find it at aristos.org.
It's not up yet. We're still finalizing it. We're a little behind schedule.
Okay. Well, let me say thank you, and here's my threat. We will have you back, Michelle, because
My
I want to continue talking to you. Folks, you can find this at ericmetaxas.com, metaxastalk.com. But if you want to go to Michelle's website, it's mmkamhi.com, mmkamhi.com. Stick around. We will be right back.
I was at the top and I was like I'm in the fish head. Number one spot, now she found her a replacement. I swear now I can't take it, knowing somebody's got my baby. And now you ain't around, baby, I can't.
I wish I could let the music play, but we're trying to do a talk radio show here. Albin.
Yes?
I do want to say
yes.
That Michelle Kami, who was our guest this hour, is incredible. We've got to get her back on the program.
Sure.
And she probably would be great for a Socrates and City event. And I want to mention, February 26th, we're going to do Socrates and City event in New York City. Fantastic.
Okay.
Exciting. And I don't know if people know. I feel like I have to repeat myself because I know there's always people who don't know. My regular website is ericmetaxas.com. Anybody who goes to ericmetaxas.com, you can see a thing that says sign up for Eric's latest thoughts or whatever. That means once a week you'll get an email from me. That's not the radio website. It's my personal website, ericmetaxas.com. And there's all kinds of information on there that's valuable. And you'll get on the website that's valuable. But also you'll get a weekly email, usually Friday afternoon. And there's just stuff on there and pictures, whatever, that we don't get to talk about on the radio program. So I want to encourage people to go to ericmetaxas.com.
Yeah, it's bonus material.
It's bonus material. But the radio website is metaxastalk.com. And at the top of that is a banner for CSI.
CSI.
Very important that we – I also want to say I go over the list every day to see who's given. And a lot of people have done exactly what I asked, and they've given a small amount. And I'm thinking of people that say, well, I can't give $156. And I say, it doesn't matter. Please give something. Anybody who can give $156, we're going to send you a hat as a thank you, and you can't get the hat anywhere else. But folks, if you can give $50, if you can give $30, if you can give $20, if you can give $15, whatever you can give, this is helping bring people out of slavery in our time. Can
yes.
you imagine in 2018 we're even discussing this? It is happening. It's horrible. The great news is you and I can do something about it. Please, folks, go to the banner, metaxastalk.com, and give whatever you can give. If you want to call, the number is 1-800-222-5909, 1-800-222-5909. In our second hour today, we're going to be talking about the great Oswald Chambers. If you don't know who he is, just listen. You need to know who Oswald Chambers is. He wrote the devotional called My Utmost for His Highest. Just a hero, a real hero, and I want people to know who he is. But before we are done with hour one, I just got to mention I got an invitation to speak in North Dakota. Albin, you saw that.
Yes,
right?
That's great.
And I realized North Dakota, that's where Mount Rushmore is. I've never visited Mount Rushmore.
Me neither.
So, of course, I would love to go to North Dakota. There are about five or six states, I think, that I still have not spoken in. I've spoken in North Dakota, but I've never spoken in South Dakota. I think that's what I said. I'm sorry.
South Dakota. Sure.
I've never spoken in South Dakota. I've spoken in North Dakota. I've spoken in Bismarck, and I've spoken in Fargo, but I've never spoken in South Dakota. I've never spoken in Hawaii. I've never spoken in Maine. I've never spoken in Alaska. I've never spoken in Mississippi. And I still think I haven't spoken in Oklahoma. I'm sure I haven't spoken in Wyoming or Montana. Anybody from one of those states, you want to invite me to some big church event or something like that, hey, I want to cross it off my list. I need to speak in all 50 states. Mm-hmm. Come on, folks.
Hey, listen, and take me with you. I don't eat much.
Wouldn't it be fun? Wow. That would be fun. Road trip to Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, road trip, baby.
Okay, so that's hour one, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. Hour two, I'm talking about Oswald Chambers, new book on him. Thanks for listening.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.